I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening. We've been away for a little bit, but we're back now and with a little bit of a different formula. Not very different, but just a little bit. In other words, you might get just a bit more of me.
That's what the people want.
No, they don't.
It is in the end.
No, don't believe a word of
it. It's your dulcet tones they want.
Absolutely not. You mean I send people to sleep?
Geoffrey Wansell storytelling tones. They love it.
Well, there you go.
They love it. The people love it, Dad.
Oh, that's very sweet of them. I do find it very amusing, though, when people write to me saying, you send me to sleep. I think, crikey. With this material, I'm sending you to sleep? My word.
Mm.
But never mind.
It gives me bad dreams if I listen to, like, scary things at night time.
Mm. Yeah. I don't really get... I mean, it's not one thing that keys off another, really.
You don't get bad dreams?
Oh, so of course everybody does at some point. But it doesn't. That doesn't do it. So we're now picking up the story we left.
Oh, yes, heading straight into the craze part two.
This is the story of the Cray twins part two.
Are we going straight in? No, there's no preamble.
No preamble.
Okay, well, here we go with the craze part two then.
For those who haven't heard part one, it's important to remind you that the Crays were iconic icons of the swinging 60s in London. They were the gangsters, but they were also celebrities. Very well known, very well connected, and very well protected by the East End, which is their manor, so to speak, in crime.
Not just the East End, by the sound of what you said last time.
Indeed, it spread into central
further
London
up,
as well.
Yep. Further up the chain.
But they had, by this point, and it bears remembering, there were two killings and a disappearance. The killings were a man called George Cornell, who worked for a competing gang in South London called the Richardsons, and a man called Jack the Hat McVitie, who was a member of the Cray's firm, who had not done something that Ronnie Cray wanted him to do and persuaded Reggie to kill him, which indeed he did. And they disposed of the body. It's another incredibly strange story. They kill McVitie and instruct two other members of the gang, of their gang, their firm, to get rid of the body, which they proceed not to do very effectively. They put him in a car and park it somewhere in East London. When the Crays hear this, they're furious, and they get another associate
to kill those two associates.
No, to go and find the car and drive it to the coast, where, believe it or not, he has to bribe a trawlerman to wrap up McVitie's body in chicken wire and then dump it at sea. I mean, it's almost laughable, but in fact, it's horrible, you know. But I think what happened now is, to some extent, the murder of McVitie, who was after all one of their gang firm, and of disappearance of Frank Mitchell, began to concern
other people in the gang.
If it can happen to him, it might happen to me. Now, a man called Detective Chief Superintendent Leonard Nipper Reed, always known as Nipper at the yard, was now in the murder squad and given specific instructions by the yard. This is in the wake of the Boothby-Dryburgh affair, which, if you listen to part one, you'll understand, that now is the time. They have to be stopped. Reed encounters the same wall of silence that he'd done 2 years before, 3 years before, because you don't snitch on your fellows. But he'd now got sufficient circumstantial evidence to swoop on all of the gang. And on the 8th of May 1968, the twins and 15 other members of the firm were arrested. Reed had calculated that he was going to get at least one of them to turn Queen's evidence, to give evidence against the Krays. The Krays, for their part, had come up with a plan to persuade three members of the firm to take the blame for the two killings and the disappearance of Frank Mitchell. But one of the men, one of the members of the firm, called Albert Donoghue, said, "I'm not doing that. I'm sorry, I'm not taking the blame. I'm not pleading guilty." He became the first member of the Krays firm to turn against them. He wasn't to be the last. But still, they maintained their innocence at all times. Eventually, they're taken to trial in 1969. It is the longest criminal trial in British legal history at that point. They were, celebrities. People flocked to see the trial. The judge was Melford Stevenson, famously tough. They were defended admirably. And their defence was simple. "We don't know anything. What are you talking about? It's got nothing to do with us." Absolute nonsense. "Can't, never heard such a complete tosh in my life, in our lives." The decisive moment in the trial of the Kray twins, because they were tried together on the two charges of murder, Cornell and McVitie, the decisive moment was when Nipper Reed and the prosecution produced the barmaid from The Blind Beggar. They didn't know that she was to be a witness.
Star witness.
She was the star witness because she identifies without a moment's hesitation at
the man
Ronnie
who
Kray,
shot him in point blank who, sh- range in who the back shot of the head.
Shot
Cornell.
Cornell. Now, at that moment, all sorts of other dominoes began to fall, particularly when it came to Reggie. And so it came to pass that the brothers, the twins, Ronnie and Reggie Kray, were convicted of the two murders. They were never charged with the disappearance of Frank Mitchell. They were simply charged with the murders of Cornell and McVitie. We would now call it joint enterprise. You might not have pulled the trigger, but you were involved. You knew what was going to happen. The judge, I think one of my favourite moments, said in sentencing, he said, "In my view, society has earned a rest from your activities."
Wow.
He gave them both life and recommended, though at that point there wasn't that minimum recommendation that there is now, but recommended they serve a minimum of 30 years in prison.
How old were they at this point?
Well, they were born in 1933 and we're now in 1969, so 36.
36.
Yeah.
30 years.
They're in their mid-30s.
Yeah.
To call it a sensation would be to underestimate. It was literally high drama at the Old Bailey, at the Central Criminal Court. And they maintained steadfastly their innocence. But they didn't shout out from the dock, as some did.
"I'm innocent, Gov."
No, they didn't shout
out. "It wasn't me, Gov."
No.
Wrong brother, Gov.
Yeah, one of those famous moments I can recall, it. Best not to repeat which man said it, who shouted at the jury, "I hope you all die of cancer."
I can guess who that was.
You probably can.
Knowing you.
Yeah.
Knowing what you've worked on.
Reggie and Ronnie were separated. They'd been in Brixton on remand before the sentencing, together. Okay, but now, for the first time, they're separated.
First time in their whole lives.
Yeah. Reggie is sent to Parkhurst on the Isle of Wight, while Ronnie is sent to Durham.
That's really far away from each
other. Quite a long way from each other. Now, Ronnie, believe it or not, who admitted later quite openly that he was bisexual, has actually fallen in love with a girl called Monica. And in his early days in prison in Durham, he tells his mother, Violet, if I can only see Monica and be with Reggie again, I'll be fine. Not surprisingly, the prison authorities, the prison service, are not too keen.
Didn't grant that wish.
On granting that. And ironically, Monica, probably the only woman Ronnie's ever loved, truly, he clearly adored her, goes on to marry another member of his gang. Ronnie doesn't cope incredibly well with Durham. And finally, he's reunited with Reggie in Parkhurst, but his mental state is by no means secure. In fact, they had a strangely symbiotic relationship. At one point, Reggie's transferred from Parkhurst to Long Larton in Worcestershire, not far from Evesham. And he gets very, very depressed. And he, believe it or not, Ronnie gets the medical superintendent in Durham to write to the medical superintendent of the prison that Reggie's now in, saying he's very worried about his mental health. He's very depressed.
Wow.
Now, can you help him?
That's so interesting.
So they see the medical superintendent, Long Larton, talks to Reggie. Reggie says, well, I am. He retired into himself. He became even more introverted than he was before. Yeah, so he may be a bit introverted, but he's fine. So they write back to Ronnie in Durham saying, well, no, Reggie's fine. There's nothing to worry about. Which doesn't satisfy Ronnie. But then Ronnie is clearly struggling with his own mental health. Mm. There's no question of that. It should also be said that Ronnie, despite being incarcerated, is running a rather a clever, how can I put it, an operation to provide security for celebrities. So if you're Frank Sinatra and you want 18 bodyguards, Ronnie's your man. It is strangely wonderful. In a way. So Reggie's left, but Ronnie steadily deteriorates. And eventually he's certified as insane, suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, and is sent to Broadmoor Secure Hospital in 1979. It is one of the most extraordinary factors that Ronnie, in many ways the more belligerent of the two twins, ends his days in Broadmoor. Whereas Reggie, by comparison, is gradually downgraded from a Category A prisoner, which is the most serious, to Category B, and finally to Category C. A number of people try and persuade the Home Secretaries of the day to release them.
Like who?
Oh, well, all kinds of people.
Well, I suppose they did have lots of friends, didn't they?
They did. But it becomes perfectly obvious that there's no way that whatever Home Secretary of the day is going to agree to release of either Ronnie or Reggie, simply because they are so notorious. They are such famous criminals. They will attract incredible attention. It should also be added that the barmaid who gave evidence against the Crays was given a new identity.
I mean, yeah, I would want that.
She was.
Yeah.
In fact, it's one of the most fascinating aspects of the whole saga is what happened to her. But never mind.
What do you mean? Is that the topic for another podcast?
Maybe. It's extraordinary, really. Ronnie, even though he's in Parkhurst, Ronnie, even though he's in Broadmoor, proceeds to marry. Not Monica, the girl he was really in love with, but two other people.
He marries twice?
He married twice in Broadmoor.
It's impressive.
The first time...
I can't get married once and I'm not in prison.
No. He married Elaine Mildener in Broadmoor in 1985 and divorced her in 1989. And almost immediately afterwards, he married Kate Howard, whom he divorced in 1994. Ronnie was eventually to die in 1995, on the 17th of March 1995, in a hospital in Slough after having had a heart attack in Broadmoor 2 days earlier, on the 15th of March. He was 61. He had terminal bladder cancer. Sorry, he had a heart attack. Reggie got the bladder cancer. Reggie meets a woman called Roberta who comes to talk to him in prison. By this point, he's not in Parkhurst. He's moved to Maidstone. Comes to talk to him about his brother, and he proceeds to marry her. She's called Roberta Jones.
They like getting married, don't they?
Yes, well, that's Reggie's second marriage. Remember the one that killed earlier? Mm-hmm. Francis, the first one. He's moved. Now, one thing I haven't said, and I perhaps should at once, is the elder brother, Charlie Cray, was also sentenced at the same Old Bailey trial as his twin brothers, but was only given 10 years for his awareness of the crime, so to speak. In fact, he only serves 7. Mm. And it gets out and becomes still a bit of a face in the East End until in 1997... He's jailed for 12 years for conspiracy to smuggle drugs, cocaine in this case. They've moved on to more profitable elements. And he died on the 4th of April 2000 of natural causes. And, of course, Reggie went to the funeral.
Was he let out of prison?
He was taken by the prison officers, yes. Both brothers had been allowed to attend the funerals of Charles, their father, and Violet, their mother, in August 1982, which was Violet's death, and March 1983, which was elder Charlie's death. Finally, and this is one of the, in many ways, rather most poignant element of this story, Reggie is actually released in late August 2000 because he's suffering from terminal bladder cancer. He's actually, by this point, in prison in Norfolk. And he goes, believe it or not, stays in a hotel with Roberta, the woman he's married.
Mm.
And he dies just a few weeks after he leaves prison. In 1st of October 2000. So... in a sense, this is a 20th century story because it ends at the beginning of the
spans
new millennium.
Spans the whole, well, yeah, half yeah. the...
A good slice the century. Of the 20th century. And in a way, it has a lot to teach us about what life was like in the 60s and this whole concept of swinging London and the way in which people admired somebody dangerous. You know, it was a different world.
Frank Sinatra was a bit dodgy, wasn't he?
Well, yes, so it was always alleged, yes. They're both buried, believe it or not, alongside their mother and father and their elder brother Charlie in Chingford, Chingford Mount Cemetery. Hmm. And you can go and see the gravestones.
I bet people do.
I think they do. Because in a way, they were an extraordinary commentary on the days we lived in then. I don't think now, given the fact of how much we deplore gang violence, that they would have been celebrities today as they were then.
No way.
I don't believe, for example, that the gang violence in Liverpool, which has seen so many deaths recently, will ever be celebrated. It's just horrifying.
Maybe they would have chosen something else. Perhaps they would have been social media influencers.
Well, it could be. It could be. I don't know what it is, but that is.
Could have been on Love Island.
Well, they could have been. They were very big. Very big chaps.
Big chaps. Hunky chaps.
Yeah, very much so. But it does. It's a fascinating commentary on
definitely
our time.
Definitely a look into a slice of life, isn't it?
Yes.
At a certain time.
But they didn't. I mean, they both spent a considerable amount of time in prison. Both died. Well, Reggie, but for 5 weeks. Died
basically
in prison.
Died in prison.
And also, it was a strange. I mean, Barbara Windsor used to go and visit them in prison. Famously. You know, they had all sorts of admirers. They were very, very famous.
It's funny that, isn't it? That's the concept of sort of overlooking violence when you like someone or they've got kind of some...
Well, they were, as I said in part one, they were regarded as both charming and prosperous and
well,
generous.
We've talked about that a lot of times before. Like, in order to be successful criminal or serial killer sometimes or close yep. to it, you do need to be charming. Can't be a weirdo. No one wants to hang out with a weirdo.
No.
Like makes you feel creepy and stuff. You want to be around someone who makes you feel good
right.
and engaged. And
yeah.
you're only going to wander off down an alleyway with someone who says, "Come with me," when you think you can trust them.
Mm. So that is, if you like, the story of Ronnie and Reggie Cray.
Ronnie and Reggie Cray. That was the Crays part two.
That was the Crays part two.
There won't be a part three, apart from when Dad does the annex extra about the barmaid from the begging blind beggar.
The barmaid from the blind beggar.
That'll be the annex.
It could be. It could be. We'll have a think about that one.
Maybe you can do it in one of your other podcasts.
Yeah. What's
your solo pods?
What else? What else are you up to? What are you doing this coming week?
I'm going to a press night in Hackney Wick.
Ooh.
Of an Indian retelling of the Cherry Orchard.
Crikey.
Which I think will be long.
It will.
I do know it's 2.5 hours long, so. And it doesn't start till 8.
Oh, groan.
And it's taken me a really long time to find someone to come with me.
I bet you it has.
We have done it.
Crikey. I've turned down the chance to go and see John Gabriel Borkman with Simon Russell Beale on the grounds that I don't need to be made more miserable than I already am.
I mean, I think that's fair. There are other hotter, more fun tickets. We didn't ever tell everyone about going to Anything Goes. We had a very jolly time.
No, we didn't. It was very jolly.
I took Dad to the Anything Goes for his birthday present.
At the bar.
Well, I put it on the Instagram so people know, but we haven't told everyone how much we enjoyed it.
We thought it was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Hey, you know what?
What?
They're doing 42nd Street at Sadler's Wells next year.
No, yes, somebody else told me that. That's very good.
So we shall go to that also. That.
That's very exciting. Mm. I look forward to that.
Me too. I like Sadler's Wells.
Crikey.
Very good view from all the seats. Similar to the Barbican.
Similar to the Barbican.
The rake is not so... There is a rake rather than stalls in West End theatres that don't have a rake.
Yeah.
Really. Unless you're under the circle, in which case you can't really see anyways.
No. No.
Oh, what about you? What are you doing next week?
Surviving.
Oh, good. Excellent.
As best I can.
Put that on your CV.
Trying to do a podcast on my own is one of the things I'm doing next week.
You shall be absolutely fine, Geoffrey. You've done it. You did it all the way through the pandemic.
So I need to remember all relearn the skills I've now forgotten.
Well, that's fine. You can do that.
But actually, I'm sure it's possible. I'm not worried about it.
Good. I'm not worried.
But we hope it'll, you know, keep the interest up. You know, talk about things that all true crime, and just keep the.
People love you, Geoffrey. They just want
to keep the.
Just want to hear your dulcet tones.
Go, keep the whole business going. That's the point, isn't it? Yes.
Keep the legacy alive.
Keep the legacy alive.
Another 5 years. How old would you be then? 80 something.
82.
To the oldest podcast host.
I should be the oldest podcast
in the UK, if not the world.
Yes, well, certainly in the UK. But I'm going to try and get some really good people to interview.
Great.
As well.
Brilliant. Fantastic.
So get some really good, interesting ones.
Sounds good.
Writers and, as I said, a policeman or two.
Mm-hmm.
That might be fun, interesting. Or maybe a forensic pathologist.
Mm-hmm.
No, you asked me about a forensic, what was it, botanist.
My colleague is interested. So the person you sent already is a published author, but what she's a books agent.
Oh,
and
okay.
She wants... like a forensic botanist who's not yet published, i.e. just someone working in the field of forensic botany who she can then turn into an author and then adapt the book and make a like TV show out of it. It's quite an interesting, like, cool idea.
It's a nice idea. I'm afraid I don't... I mean, that was the most obvious. He was the most obvious.
It's all good, all good. All good.
Forensic
botanist. Thank you.
Botanist. Yeah. It's quite funny. I get asked all sorts of odd things. You know, can you recommend an ex? You know, it's rather fun. I'm very flattered when people ask me.
Good. Right. Well, thank you to all the people that help us, to our producer Sam Brain, to my brother Dan who did the music, my friend George who drew our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, to Geoffrey for all of his hard work, and to you, the listeners. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Molly, for all your inspiration and encouragement and efforts on our behalf. We couldn't do this without you. And you're a very important part of this podcast. But as I say often at the end, bad things can happen to good people, so please do be careful out there.